Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is a man who has both an outsized portion of intelligence and the courage to bring it to bear with great effect, whom I have come to know and admire greatly in recent years. His name is Dr. Jason Hill. He is a professor of philosophy at DePaul University and the author of several books, including The Cosmopolitan, What It Means to Be a Human Being in the New Millennium. He is perhaps best known for some of his writings in periodical literature, including The Federalist, Commentary Magazine, and Salon. He's also a contributor to The Hill and Front Page magazine and has two recent essays there that we'll be talking about in the course of these two segments. Jason Hill, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start our conversation about the topic that you have particularly addressed yourself to, and I think very impactfully, notably recently on Tucker Carlson's program on Fox News, race relations in the United States. But I wanted to say one thing about you and ask you to sort of respond to it, because I think it adds such important clarity to what you think and say, and that is that you came to this country voluntarily from your native Jamaica. You've become a naturalized American citizen, which is something that would seem not to be a likely choice if this country were the systemically racist nation that we have endlessly been told it is. Talk us through that personal choice of yours and how it speaks to this larger issue.
Right. Well, I came here in 1985 at the age of 20. And I came to Atlanta in 1985 in the Deep South, 35 years ago. And I'd been in love with America from when I was a child. I thought America was the greatest republic. And I have been here for 35 years, and I've seen over the years where race relations have improved. I mean, when I lived in Atlanta, I lived actually in a neighborhood that was dominated by Klan members. There were Confederate flags in every single household, you know, and I didn't really experience any kind of hostility. And in fact, the Caribbeans just integrated the neighborhoods over a period of time and got to know the Klan's people quite well. And I have seen race relations improve. I have not seen a country that is suffused with intrinsic bigotry and racism. Quite the opposite. I've seen a land in which a place that has a self-reflexivity clause at its heart. And by that, I mean a country that is always questioning itself, questioning past grievances, questioning transgressions that it has committed against various groups that have been kept outside the domain of the ethical, whether it's, traditionally women, blacks, and have tried to do right by those groups and have tried to bring them in within the pantheon of the human community, within the domain of the ethical. I've seen a country lined with opportunities that has tried to bring those previously disenfranchised groups into positions of leadership. And now, being a professor of almost 25 years in the classroom, I've seen where the country is so progressive. I don't mean in the term that the left uses, progressive. I mean progressive in the sense of fear-minded. And so it really upsets me when I see the far left and the not-so-far left accusing this country, engaging in what I call in my book, We Have Overcome, an immigrant's letter to the American people, Americophobia, you know, accusing America of being a mean-spirited, unjust, imperialistic, racist country, when what I have witnessed over 35 years is a country that just systemically tries to overcome year after year its egregious past, the way in which it, prior to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, prior to legal segregation, has tried systematically and systemically to undo that past. That's what I've witnessed, and that's what I've experienced.
And so important, again, to have you say it so clearly. And I wanted just to really salute you for doing that, among other places, in your book, We Have Overcome, an Immigrant's Letter to the American People. This is in stark contrast, of course, with sort of the official narrative now of, well, I think the Biden-Harris administration, certainly many in Congress, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, and increasingly it seems the public, at least those who have been indoctrinated with the canon that this is, in fact, a country that will never overcome, to use your word, its racist past, will never progress to a future status in which it is authentically post-racial divided. And that's what I think is so vitally needed, is here a challenge to such propositions, because they don't seem to me to be true, and I think to an awful lot of Americans, and we don't want them to be true. So thank you again for standing up to this. One of the engines for it, of course, is something called critical race theory. And I know you've been studying this closely. You've seen it being promulgated in classrooms and of course, in federal government agencies, the United States military, among other things. We only have about a minute before we have to take a short break, Jason, but could you just quickly describe what critical race theory is about?
Well, critical race theory is, along with intersectionality, is basically a theory that was created to meant it holds that race is a social construct, which it is, but it goes further in seeing that race permeates every and suffuses every aspect of life. It threatens to dismantle the liberal order and the liberal values that have suffused it questions the very foundation of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, Enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law, and seeks to replace it with something called equity, which is equal results for everyone. So critical race theory seeks to find racism in every aspect of life. So long as there are not equal outcomes among groups, it attributes that to racism. And we know that that's just false.
Hold the thought. We're going to come back to a further discussion of equity and what it really is driving us to with Dr. Jason Hill, the author of We Have Overcome, an Immigrant's Letter to the American People, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with one of the most courageous men I know. His name is Dr. Jason Hill. He's a professor at DePaul University, working deep behind enemy lines, I'm afraid, but he is forthright, he is clear-eyed, and he loves this country. And he's not going to pull any punches when it comes to explaining what is being done to it that is both wrong, factually, and also insidiously damaging in the form of sort of a divide-and-conquer strategy, I believe, aimed at exploiting and intensifying racial divisions. Jason Hill, you left us in the last block with a term that I think really does require further illumination, and that is equity. We're beginning to hear it a lot. It's not to be confused with the word equality. What's the difference, and why does the difference matter so much?
Well, when we talk about equality in the American sense, we're really talking about equality before the law. That is, the 1964 Civil Rights Act was meant to establish something that I think all Americans stand behind, at least one aspect of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was blacks enjoy full equality before the law. When the Founding Fathers said all men are created equal, I think what they meant was that all men are created with equal moral intrinsic worth and value, some of whom violate that intrinsic moral worth, and that all men should, all human beings should enjoy full legal standing before the law. Now, that's very different from equity. Equity means, demands legislating equal result among all persons. That is, equity demands legislating equal results from unequal causes, equal rewards for unequal performance. So what the equity advocates want to do is, if you give $1,000 to five people and the results are different at the end of 1 year, that for them is disastrous. They want equal results from all persons who are given the same allocations. And that's just impossible.
Well, and unless, Jason, you have the state redistributing the outcomes of those different people's work or use of the resources or what have you, and achieving an artificial equity by, you know, effectively taking money from one to give it to one who did not perform so well. That's how, I guess, this ultimately works out. And that's socialism or communism, is it not?
That would be the case. But what I also want listeners to understand is that equity rests on a very false belief. It rests on the idea that we're actually born equal. We're not. Not everyone is born with equal intelligence. Not everyone is born with equal athletic prowess. I'm certainly not the athletic equal of my countryman Usain Bolt, who is the fastest or was the fastest runner in the world. So we're not born with equal sense of frugality. We're not born with equal beauty. We're not born equal. We're born with different talents. And results are often the consequences of how the virtues of our character manifest themselves in how we apply virtues in our lives. So you can't redistribute virtues, right? Results are often the... So I decided to be a philosopher. My best friend decided to be a hedge fund manager. He earns a lot more money than I do as a hedge fund manager. I think we're both equal in intelligence, but I can't sit there and say that the disparity in income between us both is due to racism. He happens to be white. I happen to be a Jamaican immigrant. We had the same opportunities. I could have decided to become, I got into an MBA program. I decided I wanted to be a philosopher. So what the equity advocates do is also is that they reduce all disparities in outcomes. They reduce it to racism when it's just not the case.
And so a country that is rooted in the proposition that there is equality before the law, as you say, and equality of opportunity. If you use what skills you have, if you use, you know, hard work, if you apply yourself, you will make your way, whether it's as a hedge fund manager or as a professor in a university or in any other walk of life. The outcomes may not be the same, but you have an opportunity, an equal opportunity to succeed at your chosen task. That seems to me to be the definition of America, the American dream, which you revered and voluntarily came to enjoy and have done, I think, both well by it yourself and also made a huge contribution to our country in the process. Talk a little bit more, if you would, Dr. Hill, about the efforts that those who are promoting this equity agenda use, whether it's sort of under the rubric of critical race theory or their political activism or other, you know, indoctrination of our kids and similar techniques, to foster this idea of grievances and victimhood that, you know, sort of gives impetus to this idea that racism is systemic and it's now brutalizing you, and therefore you are entitled to things, including things that you may not work for.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think there are two motives that run concurrently alongside each other. One is, of course, I think this is all a form of propaganda, Marxist propaganda, to usher in a kind of socialism. Any advocate of equity is and redistribution the redistribution of wealth, which is what the equity advocates want. Kamala Harris has said that it's only a massive redistribution of wealth that can bring about an equality that could lessen the income gap among groups, and that racism is the cause of this, has a Marxist agenda underlying it. So this is a very subtle, I mean, because it sounds wonderful. When people think equity, they think equality. Who could be against equity unless they really understand the nefarious reasoning behind it? So it's an appeal to people's sentiment and emotional sentiments to usher in and to sneak in socialism incrementally into this country.
For the purpose, let's be clear, I think you would agree, Jason, of taking the country down. I mean, this is a fundamental transformative agenda that Barack Obama spoke of before he became president and has been pursuing, as has Kamala Harris and I think Joe Biden, or certainly their handlers, ever since, no?
That's right. That's right. I think Obama was very open about, but he was more subtle, actually. I mean, but he I think, was vociferous in the equity notion. I mean, his wife spoke about that we're just renters, and that we're not really the owners of our wealth. We're just sort of the custodians of what we have.
You didn't build this. Yeah. And we're not proud of this country and so on. Yeah. Let me turn quickly to one piece of this, which is now rearing its ugly head in California and North Carolina and other states, and even at the federal level, which is driven by this kind of grievance victimhood agenda. Talk a bit about this idea of reparations to Black folks who have some claim by virtue of all of that to the state's resources.
Right. Well, you know, Governor Newsom was the first, Gavin Newsom was the first official to sign into law an investigation or a proposal for studying potential reparations. And he affixed his signature to that proposal and announced nationwide that he said, I like what's going on. This is not just about California. This is about making an impact, a dent across the country. What he was responding to Shirley Weber, who authored the legislation, and she said, basically what she said is that those who had lived under slavery are not actual slave holders, but they benefit from white privilege. And she said, this country owes America not income redistribution, but reparations. And so we have something called H.R. 40, which is a piece of legislation to bring in the process of introducing into the House of Representatives in Washington, a legislative procedure that would begin reparations, and it has the support of President Biden and endorsement of Kamala Harris.
And you address this basic problem in your newest book, which is not quite out yet, but apparently is selling like hotcakes, entitled What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. Give us a quick introduction to the thesis of the book.
Well, the thesis is to put the reparations argument to death. I mean, I take these claims very seriously, and I go through the beginnings of from 1776, although blacks might have been left out of the domain of the ethical, the foundations for black freedom were being established by even people who held slaves like Jefferson. Surprisingly, readers who are history buffs will enjoy this. But I really concentrate on the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and I argue quite contentiously that reparations have already been paid from the affirmative actions, from Lyndon Johnson's great initiative programs, the war on poverty, the billions of dollars in welfare aid that has that has been distributed to blacks. There have been numerous what I call reparative moments from 1964 to the present. So reparations have been made, and any sort of discriminatory acts against blacks, like redlining and so on, belong in courts of law, not in reparations.
Jason Hill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a topic, though, to which I hope we can return with you soon, because it's likely to be central to the further evolutions of this, race hatred mongering that I believe is an affliction now unleashed by Black Lives Matter and to some extent even the Biden-Harris administration itself. Thank you for your courage in taking on these issues and, again, the clarity with which you address them. We appreciate so much your work and look forward especially to the book What Do White Americans Owe Black People? When it's out, we'll be talking about that with you too. Stay well, my friend. In the meantime, God bless you. Next up, we will speak with Lawrence Reed about socialism's other attributes in the economic space and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it's a delight to say welcome for the first time, I believe, to Secure Freedom Radio of a former professor and public policy champion, former president of the Foundation for Economic Education, and the author, among other things, of Was Jesus a Socialist? His name is Lawrence Reed, and I'm very pleased to catch up with him to talk about socialism, which seems to be the coming thing for the Biden-Harris team, and what that portends for our country. Lawrence Reed, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So you've written this book and had a wildly popular Prager University video of the same name, Was Jesus a Socialist? And it's a marvelous way of sort of introducing to an audience that may know rather more about Christ than socialism, that the twain don't actually meet. Talk us through that, if you would.
Okay. Much of this question hinges upon the definition of socialism. If you think that socialism is nothing more than giving people things, caring for them, and so forth, some people among the more naive think that that's what it is, well, then you could make a case that Jesus must have been sympathetic. But that's not what socialism is. It, in reality, is the concentration of power for the purposes of forcibly redistributing wealth or accumulating property in the hands of the government or providing a welfare state, robbing Peter to pay Paul, central planning of the economy. That's what socialism actually is. And when you look at the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament, you'll find that there is not a single word that would suggest he would favor any of those aspects of socialism, none of that forcible redistribution or concentration of power.
And of course, socialism as an ideology was not a thing in Jesus' time either. There's that small detail. But the point you're making, I think, is really telling, that the sorts of characteristics of this, fundamentally, this instrument for power, acquiring it and utilizing it, was not in the sort of teachings or precepts of Jesus Christ. And thankfully, that's the case. There's also this problem, Lawrence, of socialism is not so much an ideological phenomenon in its own right. It is part of a larger communist agenda, is it not? And when you look at what communism entails, not only is it deeply hostile to Christianity and every other form of religion, it really is fundamentally at odds with everything that Jesus taught, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And from the days of Karl Marx and his writings to the present day, communists are very much opposed to religion of any kind, and especially Christianity. They want to substitute the state for God, and they concentrate power in the hands of flawed mortal beings, which is something that Jesus himself never endorsed.
When you say hostile, I think that is an understatement. You look at what communist states like the Soviet Union and now Communist China, due to believers among other faith communities usually, but they seem to have a special enmity towards Christians. It's really appalling that anyone would suggest that that Jesus was a socialist, let alone that he would be, you know, party to this larger program of which socialism is kind of the starter drug, if you will. Which brings me to a very interesting piece that you wrote recently that sort of walks you through, well, you called it another dumb reason to take your money in an online outlet called El American. Talk a bit about some of these elements of what socialists are up to that ought to be, you know, appalling and anathema, really, to Americans who are now being, as I say, at least incrementally induced to believe that it's the wave of the future by the Biden-Harris team.
Yeah, if you listen to socialists, you'll find that they don't have a laundry list of helpful suggestions or, you know, here's some ideas for people to consider. And if you don't like them, that's OK. That's not the the way socialists behave or express themselves. They have a laundry list of things they want to mandate and force upon people, impose upon them. And it's just never ending, whether it's in healthcare or anything else. And this most recent example that you alluded to in that article I wrote, another dumb reason to take your money, concerns a state legislator in Connecticut. Now, I don't know if he's a socialist, but he's certainly in that left-wing camp somewhere. And he wants to fine people who don't vote. Even though, you know, not voting sometimes is a way of personal expression. It's a way of for some people to say, I don't think the process is fair, or I don't like the candidates, or, you know, any number of other reasons. But this guy wants to fine you if you don't vote.
You put it so succinctly and I think tellingly when you said socialists call the cops for everything. And that really captures what is at the heart of this. It is, as I said, antithetical to the freedoms that we believe are God-given and certainly guaranteed and protected by our Constitution. And that's what's so troubling about what Biden and company have in mind here is it seems to be pretty much full-on assault on those constitutional freedoms. Talk a little bit about socialism and science too, Lawrence. We hear a lot about, you know, the science being on their side and justifying all kinds of edicts, most notably, of course, at the moment with respect to the COVID or CCP virus, as I tend to call it, but also, you know, the whole climate change business. Where does this actually fit into the program of socialism science?
Well, even though they always claim that they are driven by science and facts and so forth, quite the opposite is usually the case. If they were interested in the science of, say, human nature, they would recognize that each of us is a unique being, unlike any other that ever existed, and that therefore suggests that each of us should be free to develop our uniqueness and our personalities. But they have a program, you might say, that attempts through one step after another to homogenize us, collectivize us in a kind of communal blender, and they don't recognize the importance of individuals. That's why under capitalism, if you want to pretend socialism, you can rustle up freely your neighbors and say, hey, let's put everything in a common pot that we have and distribute it equally. You're free to do that if you can find anybody willing to do it with you. But under socialism, yeah, exactly. But under socialism, you can't be a capitalist. I mean, it's very telling that they resort to the use of concentrated power and force to accomplish everything, which is why I said they call the cops for almost any purpose.
Yeah. I want to read another passage from this terrific piece at El American. You lead it off by saying, socialists are know-it-alls and know-nothings simultaneously. This is a remarkable achievement, perhaps socialism's singular contribution to sociology. Even if a socialist's own life is a mess, he still knows how to run everybody else's. I thought that was epic. And you know, this is the thing again. We tend to believe, many of us in this country, that socialism has been an abject failure, that the, you know, the end of the Soviet Empire and the collapse of the USSR and the wall in Berlin being taken down and so on were proof positive that this was all, as Reagan used to say, on the ash heap of history. And yet, Lawrence Reed, I think you're devoting your life to trying to warn us that this is afoot again. This is very much now in the mix inside the United States. And do you attribute that to, you know, basically having allowed Marxists to run our academic institutions for the past generation or two?
Oh, I think that is the lion's share of where it's coming from, Frank. And it's not just that the academic institutions we think of as higher education. It's even worked its way into K-12, often propagated by teachers who themselves don't realize the extent to which they've been indoctrinated, who think they're doing fine, but don't even recognize that there is another side sometimes. So it's permeating academia from top to bottom.
We were talking in the previous segments with Dr. Jason Hill about, you know, how the critical race theory folks have been doing a similar kind of thing. And really, it's all part of this, you know, hostile ideology and its efforts to take us down from within, it seems to me, whether you call it socialism or communism or Marxism or, you know, racial theory or whatever. It's working its way through the institutions, and it is now in full flower, it seems, in our Congress and in our White House. And I just want to say thank you for the work that you have been doing at the Foundation for Economic Education, and for your works on, you know, Is Jesus a Socialist? And the other book, which we haven't gotten to, but I'd love to visit with you about on another occasion if we could, Real Heroes, Inspiring True Stories of Courage, Character, and Conviction. I have the feeling that we're in desperate need of a few models for such courage at a moment when we really need to be standing up against this socialist agenda. Lawrence Reed, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon, if you would. It's been a delight to talk with you, and appreciate what you've been doing. Next up, we'll talk with Robert Spencer about the Jihad status report right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, a fellow, senior fellow, a very distinguished senior fellow at that, of the Center for Security Policy. He's also the director of Jihad Watch and a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. A man of many parts, the author of more than 20 books, including The Truth About Muhammad, a topic to which we will turn in a moment. His name, of course, is Robert Spencer. Always a welcome guest here. It's good to have you back, sir. How are you?
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you. Good.
Thank you. Listen, I wanted to get sort of your appreciation of what is going on with Iran at the moment. We have the Biden administration, of course, frantically trying to endear itself to the Iranians, but there's an awful lot of stuff that seems to be at cross purposes with that going on at the moment. Let's talk us through it, if you would, Robert.
The Iranians understand that the Biden administration wants rapprochement with them at any cost. And so they are taking the opportunity, seizing the opportunity to pursue their global agenda, aggression against Israel, enabling of jihad groups around the world, and more. And they realize that Biden is not going to do anything to stop them, but ultimately will cling to the path of appeasement no matter what. So this is their This is their moment.
So he did strike at some of their terrorist proxy forces in Syria in retaliation for the penultimate round of rockets fired at a base where American forces are stationed in Iraq. They've done it again, apparently, those same Iranian-backed militia, we're told. How does this fit into either the current approach of the Biden team? Are they likely to strike again, would you say? And is it going to make any impact in the quality of the rapprochement that they're pursuing?
I think that they probably will strike again, but that ultimately this will not make any difference in their overall policy of appeasement. It might seem strange at first glance, but the Biden administration has to balance several constituencies. One of them is those who want the deal with Iran back on and appeasement of Iran at any cost. The other is the Muslim Brotherhood lobby in the United States, the Islamic organizations in the U.S. that are linked to the Muslim Brotherhood that see Iran as an enemy and are happy with the strike. It's noteworthy that Nihad Awad of CARE has a great deal about Jamal Khashoggi on his Twitter feed, but nothing about the strike in Syria. Clearly, he approves of it because it aids Muslim Brotherhood interests. But then it's also worth noting that at the same time that the strike took place in Syria, South Korea, with the approval of the Biden administration, released $8 billion of frozen assets to Iran. And so it
$8 billion, that's the highest number I've heard so far.
Yeah, that's correct. And it seems to me to be clear that what's happening is that the by way of South Korea and no doubt by way of others in the future, the Biden administration is reassuring Iran that the Syrian strikes do not mean that the overall course of appeasement will be changed.
Let's turn the lens a little bit. The Iranians are alleged to have struck an Israeli vessel in the Gulf of Oman. The Israelis have retaliated for that by striking Iran-associated assets in Damascus, Syria. How does that fit into this overall effort by the Biden administration to, you know, keep a lid on things with the Iranians, shall we say? Are we likely to see this escalating between Iran and Israel?
Yes, I think escalation is almost certain. With while Biden is pursuing his balancing act between appeasing the Muslim Brotherhood and appeasing Iran, the Israelis are the losers in both scenarios. I mean, in both cases. So the Israelis recognize this. They recognize the import of the fact that Biden took so long to call Netanyahu after he was inaugurated, the longest gap in 40 years between an inauguration and the American president contacting the Israeli prime minister.
No accident, comrade, as the Soviets like to say.
Yeah, exactly. And so even though he ultimately did call and everything is supposed to be fine, it's just that he was busy or whatever, the Israelis aren't stupid and they know what it means. And so they know they're on their own and that they have to strike against Iran because they can't count on the United States right now.
Especially as this nuclear capability seems to be more and more at hand for the Iranians, if not already in hand. Robert, let me turn to something you touched on a moment ago. You mentioned that Nihad Awad, one of the preeminent Muslim Brotherhood leaders in the United States, runs an organization called the Council on American-Islamic Relations, with which you and I are both very familiar. He is very aggressively pushing out this idea that there must be retribution against the Saudis. There was a time when the Muslim Brotherhood was very much enamored of the Saudis and depending on them for their support. That day has passed, evidently. What's the state of play there?
Yes, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has withdrawn support from the Muslim Brotherhood, and Turkey has taken up the slack. It has largely abandoned its pursuit of spreading Wahhabism around the world, which it's pursued for decades, of course, and is apparently sincere in attempting to reform. But it is, of course, still a repressive
regime. This is Saudi Arabia you're talking about?
And it's still a repressive regime. There's no doubt Jamal Khashoggi was murdered by the regime. And the Biden administration is now apparently embarked upon the process of using that and using the Saudi involvement, the Saudi government's involvement in his murder to weaken ties between Saudi Arabia and the United States, all as part of the appeasement of Iran. The Muslim Brotherhood is thrilled by this. Because the Saudi government turned against them in its reform efforts, they're very happy to see it all happening. And that's why Awad is so very concerned that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, somehow be made to pay for the death of Khashoggi.
One other story that you featured at Jihad Watch in recent days was the subject of a conversation I had with Daniel Greenfield yesterday. Another of the backers of the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, as you know, Robert, is Qatar. And apparently, according to Daniel, the Qataris have decided that they are going to amp up their broadcasting, their influence operations of Al Jazeera, aimed at conservatives in the United States. Tell us what you make of that and how much this signals the really unreliable quality, shall we say, of Qatar, which is putatively an ally of the United States in the Persian Gulf.
Well, Qatar is Muslim Brotherhood, and so they're pursuing the Muslim Brotherhood's goals. And we know that those goals, according to the famous explanatory memorandum, the captured internal document of the Brotherhood about which you've written so much, and I've written about as well, the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood is eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within. So by appealing to conservatives, they're trying in the first place to exacerbate the divisions in the American political sphere and to take advantage of the fact that the American left is working so assiduously now to deny any platform to political dissent. And if the Qataris fill that gap, then presumably they can count on conservative leaders who have never really grasped the nature and magnitude of the jihad threat. They can count on them to be softer toward the Muslim Brotherhood. So you can imagine a scenario in which people respond to Ted Cruz trying to get the Brotherhood labeled a terrorist organization by saying they're the only ones enabling us to speak.
A deviously clever plot, if that is in fact what they're up to, and insidious, to be sure. Finally, and we don't have a lot of time for this topic, I think we're going to have to return to it soon, but very quickly, could you give us a flavor of what you are saying about the question of, did Muhammad exist? Robert Spencer.
Yeah, my book, Did Muhammad Exist?, will be out in July, and it is an exploration of the earliest texts available about Islam. And one of the most extraordinary things is that in the first 60 years of the Arab conquests, as they conquered the Middle East, North Africa, Persia, and part of India, there's no mention of Islam or the Quran or Muhammad. There are some mentions of the name Muhammad, but no connection, no idea that this is the prophet of a new religion, none of the proliferation of the stories that we get, that we take for granted today as being the historical record of Muhammad. Those actually date from the 9th century, 200 years after he's supposed to have lived. And so it's very likely that the whole thing is more myth than myth and legend, more myth and legend than history.
We need you to come back and talk to us at length about this. Would prefer to do it before the book is out, but we may have to wait on it. But either way, we look forward to a further conversation with you. Robert Spencer, thank you for all you do and all you write, most especially at jihadwatch.org, among other places. Come back to us again next week if you would. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.